You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are here in our final week discussing Benjamin Stevenson's Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone. All the way to the end, the spoilers are in full tow. And also in full tow is Roderick Chambers, back from the dead at last.
Yay!
Here to join us to talk about Benjamin Stevenson's just incredible metafictional murder mystery. Rod, welcome to Death of the Reader. It's wonderful to finally have you after a few scheduling mishaps, which I will take the full blame for.
I'm so excited to be here, Flex.
So I guess the thing that we wanted to get into first here is that this book goes from metafiction to metafiction to metafiction, and then sort of wraps up in, I guess, an unsurprisingly quaint murder mystery way, the denouement in the library.
It ties everything up in a neat little bow, which I think is really nice. But to be fair, the library has been foreshadowed so many times with its great big fireplace and all the burnable books. And like, it shouldn't be a surprise that we end our journey here with the whole family gathered together, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you've got to have a library, haven't you? And, you know, I in Agatha Christie tradition, expected all people to be sitting around and going through each one. And it kind of, you kind of start that way, don't you? But then things happen.
I really enjoy actually the scene where we watch Ernie, who has been unsure of his footing with the family and in the mystery in both regards, all the way through the book. You know, he keeps telling us, I like to see things in two different ways, and I'm going to present both of them to you, reader, so that I can think about it in my own head and figure out how to tell my story and tell you what I was thinking at the time. But when it comes to the breakdown scene with the family, he only has one thing to say, and that is the truth, because he is a detective and he's great and he absolutely nails every single character and all of the nonsense they've been getting up to as they've been running around the lodge.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other great thing about the breakdown scene with Ernie is that he, as our narrator, is sort of commenting on the fact that he didn't really know exactly what he was getting into in his spiel, but as the pieces were starting to fall into place with his explanation, he just keeps going. So he gets up to, like, why was the money $267,000 instead of $300,000? Oh, Lucy, I haven't explained her yet. It must be because Michael gave her the money. And it ends up being true as best we know it, but it is still sort of this, like, flying by the seat of his pants feeling.
And, of course, he's a bit like you guys, isn't he? I mean,
what does that mean?
And our lovely listeners out there, because he knows the way that people write murder mysteries.
Yeah.
He is a murder mystery analyst.
Mm-hmm.
He's like you guys. So he's now in it himself. Like it's things within things, isn't it? It's circles within circles. I love that.
Well, I mean, I did enjoy the line where someone's like, oh, well, you write murder mysteries, right? And he's like, no, I write guidebooks on Amazon.
That he sells for
$2. Yeah.
Finally, his skill set is coming to the front. Finally, it's useful, right?
Finally, in his whole life, something has become useful, yes. And I suppose, is there about one person in his family that he likes, which is the in-law, really.
Sophia.
Sophia.
And the rest of them he hates in one way or another. And so, you know, he's kind of the person that is least wants to be there.
I love Andrew. He is my favorite character now because coming back to who you'd spill blood for, you know, we come to the climax, the action-packed finale, and he absolutely yeets a poker into the jaw of someone who's trying to take his dear wife away from him. And again, it comes down to that perception of who he is, because the only person who can save his wife is him. He steps up to the plate and
reliably sticks that poker
through. He does. Oh, yeah. He sticks it straight through the killer's jaw.
Yeah.
And I love the way that it's framed for that impact as well, where just as he's swinging the poker, we get the cut to the page that says, my uncle.
Yeah.
This is compounding the fact that when Crawford says, who in this family has not killed someone? You've all killed someone. And Andrew kind of sheepishly raises his hand as if to say, I haven't killed anyone. I haven't been in a situation where I would do that. I'm different from the rest of you.
What a great piece of foreshadowing,
it's so
right?
Good. Oh. It's
well,
so
I
good.
Well, I love the way these chapters come about. And the one that's my favorite, of course, is I think it's chapter 18. Is it chapter 18 or chapter 8? One or the other. Maybe it's got an 8 in it. But it's the one where it was my wife.
I don't want to talk about it.
I don't want to talk about it.
I don't want to talk about it.
That's great.
Stop. Then we go on to the next chapter. I think it's just lovely. It just says volumes about it. And he's obviously using that device of the way the chapters end and begin and so forth is perfect because they're all such nice little neat episodes.
I love that you, well, you say that, but the uncle chapter doesn't even have a chapter number. It's the same chapter as the previous chapter.
Yeah. I mean,
well, that's another little piece.
It's a subversion, right? It's a cheeky subversion.
It's a cheeky subversion. And it's also the most effective way I've ever seen a smash cut used in text.
Yes.
Like, what a fantastic way to use the medium to convey something narratively that, like, yes, we've been building to this moment of Andy committing murder. Here's the drop. I guess the other thing in terms of parallels that I did want to talk about is the pigeon. Because you were quite right. The pigeon was indeed a parallel to Michael bringing a last dying message.
Before getting murdered.
Yeah. Being,
for his heroism. Because that's what happens to the pigeon. It brings the code. It sets everything up for the soldiers to succeed. And then for its, you know, final moments, he gets shot and stuffed. Like,
And that's, I mean, that was the first thing he noticed when he walked into that room, wasn't it? The pigeon. So that's a sign, isn't it? As good, you know, detective murder novel people, you would notice that's
– well,
you'd note that down in your notes, wouldn't you?
Of course I would.
Yes, of course.
And I definitely knew exactly what was going on in the first week after it had been mentioned, and Flex did not needle me for it. I had no clue what it meant at the time. I didn't figure it out until after Michael's death.
Yeah, but I mean – it's also on the mantelpiece that catches on fire.
Of course it is. Which, it's above the fireplace that burns the lodge down. Like, that room is one big metaphor for the story.
It's fantastic.
I love
it. You think, oh, that pigeon, you know, it's so sad. But you don't think there's going to be the medal is going to be the pigeon initially either, do you? I mean, you don't necessarily think that pigeon is going to be the hero of the piece. And it was a hero, that pigeon.
It really was. But I think I was on the money with that pigeon. There wasn't much in this book that I think I managed to solve the first time through, but the pigeon I was on the money for.
Now, who fell off the roof?
Lucy.
Lucy. I felt that was a little bit. That was a little bit stagey, you know. It happened so suddenly, and it gets rid of her, and we didn't really know much about her, and I wasn't liking her that much. And
Lucy's such a bizarre character because, as you say, she's a smoker, she's an idiot, she brought the killer here. It is a bit stagey.
So I was a bit disappointed with that. I thought that, you know, something else could have done a bit more with that somehow. I don't know, just falling off the roof. You know.
I mean, the thing is, she killed herself. Is the thing. It was suicide.
Yes.
You don't think that the drama of that moment plays into that, kind of uplifts that moment for you? You just satisfied?
I don't know, maybe it was the timing, or it was like, oh, we're due for another murder now. And so, oh, we'll get Lucy going off the roof. I just don't know whether she would do that, really.
Well, the thing is I felt that Lucy's role in the story in that way was pretty mechanical in that, like, she is the one that brought the killer there. She is the one that brings the kill count to everyone by killing herself. Like, she serves a very by-the-numbers role in the story.
She's also killed at the moment where she figures out what's going on because she's the one who actually knows what's going on, right? It makes sense that she figures it out even if she's a dummy, because she's the one who brought the killer here.
But we know that, right? We know that she knows.
We know by the end of the story that she knows.
Didn't we know then? Didn't we think, I bet she knew something. Isn't it a bit convenient that she fell off the roof?
Should you have solved this novel and gotten all the points?
Probably.
Probably indeed. But the thing that I do like about that role in the story is that there is often that sort of thing in crime fiction, and especially mystery fiction, where you have to accept the premise of the story to continue. For example, we were talking a friend through The Devotion of Suspect X a while ago, and that story begins on page one with you seeing the murder happen. So what's the mystery to solve?
The how did it happen, surely.
Well, the how is shown to you as well in the moment. But again, if a murder mystery is showing you everything on the first page and there's still 400 pages to go, as Benjamin Stevenson says, unless you're in the high 80s, you should be expecting some kind of twist, something that you're missing. You just don't realize that you're missing it.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So the thing with Lucy is that she is the embodiment of that principle where I know what's happened. I've maybe solved the mystery one thing or another, but I still have to accept the premise of her landing the story on that next step. And it doesn't always feel fantastic, as with Lucy, but when we're doing genre criticism, whether or not Benjamin Stevenson intended it, I think it works really well as unpacking the way the tropes of the genre work.
I forgave it.
Good. Good I'm glad on you. You did.
I'm glad you're the forgiving type because I'm not. Benjamin Stevenson, fight me. No, I shouldn't say that.
Alrighty, we should wrap this part of the discussion here and head over to the mystery in just a bit. Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here with you. Out at the end of 2022, Michael Stanley's latest novel is A Deadly Covenant and follows Detective Kubu to Shikawe, Botswana, on a case investigating a mass grave of First Nations Africans holed up amidst preparations for a new waterline through the Kalahari Desert. We're thrilled to be joined by Michael Sears and Stanley Trollope, the minds behind this sweltering mystery. Michael, Stanley, welcome to Death of the Reader. It's wonderful to have you both.
Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
So, we're 8 books into Detective Kubu's novels, and you've brought us back to his rookie days whilst he's still courting his later wife, Joy. Did it feel like Kubu was getting too competent later down the timeline? Why did you need to dial him back a bit?
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. One was that in our first book, A Carrion Death, Kubu wasn't actually designed to be the protagonist of the series. He just... A body is discovered, an ecologist discovered it, and we've both been professors in previous lives. So, you know, they say, write what you know. So we were writing about a professor, and we thought the professor was going to be the protagonist. But if a murder occurs, you've got to have a policeman. So Kubu just walked out of the criminal investigation department in Gaborone, climbed into his Land Rover with some drinks and some food and some cassette tapes to sing along to, and he headed off into the desert. And by the time he got to the body, he'd basically taken over the whole story. That was all fine and good, and he was the key detective in the Botswana CID, and so he was for six novels in the series. But there wasn't really any backstory to him, in a sense. So we felt that was a bit of a gap, and we wanted to fill that gap. So we wrote a couple of prequels to try and do that. And A Deadly Covenant is the second of those prequels.
Well, Flex and I, we're a working duo, much like yourselves. And though, of course, we agree on everything down to the detail that the other person says without question, not everyone is blessed with this synchronicity. How do the two of you, especially being pantsers and kind of riding the wave as you go along the writing process, how do you deal with creative disagreements and maintain the illusion of the hive mind known as Michael Stanley?
We do try and get together physically in the sense of being in the same location at the same time, because we do deal with each other at arm's length, shall we say. And so sometimes when we have creative disagreements, the fact that the arm's length is for a very long arm is quite useful. But we start off by getting together, and we try and sort of structure some ideas, structure some characters, and try and find out what the book's really about and how's it going to develop in general terms.
One of the amazing things that I've learned over the course of 10 or 11 books nine we've written together, that it doesn't really matter how you say things, that you know, if I think I have made the perfect chapter or the perfect paragraph, turns out that Michael's version of it could be equally good, which is really irritating, but it's true.
I can relate.
What? What are you talking about?
So we often have very heated disagreements about small things. And we, way back when we started writing, we started writing nearly 20 years ago, we created a sort of a protocol for handling these enormous disagreements. And that was, if we couldn't agree, the person who wrote it first would get to keep it. And if it was really bad, we just said, well, the editor will take care of it. In those 20 years, we may have had two or three uses of the protocol. And in every case, the editor hasn't even noticed that there's been a disagreement.
I really enjoy that. One interesting theme that you tackle through the setup of the novel is the disconnect between the positive effects of infrastructure and the damage that's done to get there. In this case, that's a waterline through the Kalahari. What do you think makes Khubu and his youth the perfect pair of eyes to tangle with the injustice of ignorance?
Khubu is a complex person. He obviously is devoted at this stage in his life to his job, but he's also, I think, has a sort of more, you know, 10,000 meter view of the world. And the reality in Botswana is that there are many pressures, both in Botswana and in Namibia, to tap off water from the Cabango River, which would, if that happened, it has the potential of destroying a unique habitat. And I think that Khubu understands those different things. And in his head, he's sort of juggling them, but his police perspective always comes through first because that's his job.
The scene that I was also thinking of is the one in this novel where we're talking about him learning how to be observant and why he chose to become a detective in that moment with the trapdoor spider, and that idea that the things that you want to be most careful of a sort of hidden in plain sight.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that trapdoor spider is actually something that happened to me, basically. You know, I was on a trip, and one of the people we were with basically, you know, said, "What do you see?" And, you know, he pointed to this little crescent in the sand and literally got a little twig and lifted the lid, and out popped this white trapdoor spider. And it is astonishing, you know, when you spend time in the bush, that there are so many things that you don't see. And the more time you're just slowing down and just looking is really very revealing, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's sort of interesting looking at the rest of the series then. I heard, for example, Stanley Yu speaking at Poison Pen Press at the end of last year. Barbara Waters there was talking about where this book crosses over with Death of the Mantis. And obviously that kind of is the overlapping themes throughout the series of like the flames of prejudice, the treatment of the land and the edges where cultures meet. Why do you think A Deadly Covenant veers into these little spaces where it feels so familiar to the previous books in the series? Is there an aspect of you like trying to say things that you felt were incomplete in previous books or reflections on thoughts that were the genesis of previous books in the series?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I haven't actually thought about it before, but Bushmen play a huge role in our thinking. But we've always been intrigued by both by the Bushmen themselves, and we're very interested in the relationship between the Bushmen and the other cultures in Botswana. One of the things that we often bring up, just to put a perspective in, and I think that you'll understand this being in Australia, it was in the 1930s that the last licenses were issued to hunt Bushmen.
Surprisingly recent. Yeah. It's kind of uncomfortable thought, right?
Well, it is. And so, I mean, that is so, I mean, there are people alive who were in that era very easily. And so the plight of the Bushmen is sort of in our writing DNA in this particular series. There's no shortage of interesting ways of looking at all those relationships.
I thought that the first person views of Salelo speaking with his ancestors around the fire at night were a really interesting touch in how we lend credibility to spiritualism through giving it their perspective. With characters like Marzondo linking the crown to Mami Water, what do we stand to learn by taking the lens of traditional spiritualism for where it collides with modernity?
Well, I think again that's a very interesting question. So it's not only possible to intertwine these things, but it's almost essential because it's really the back story of the whole culture. It's the backdrop of the whole culture, and the way in which people react to these things is built into the modern culture.
All righty. Well, this has been an absolute treat, and I had a fantastic time going through A Deadly Covenant. So thank you for sending it over, and thank you so much for joining us here on Death of the Reader. It's been such a blast finally getting to have Detective Khubu and yourselves here on the show.
Thank you very much.
We've enjoyed it a lot.
You're listening to Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. A Deadly Covenant by Michael Stanley is out with Arenda Books and Michael Stanley's own White Sun Books. We'll have links up on the podcast if you want to get that. Stick around, more to come. You're on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3, Flex and Herds, joined by Roderick Chambers of The Wire fame amidst other escapades, ruling the nation secretly from under his iron fist. And Rod, unfortunately, due to some scheduling shenanigans, you weren't here to pose a theory on the previous episode of the show. And again, I take full blame for those. But I'd love to know if you could tell us a little bit about what you were thinking in the lead up to the reveal in this book. Had you figured out Jeremy?
I guess I was feeling, I had the heavy weight of suspicion upon me. But, you know, I wasn't really putting the effort in that probably you guys would have to go back and check things. There's a lot of things in here that you probably should be checking, but I'd rather just keep reading.
Well, yeah.
And so I just kept reading. So no. So short answer is probably I should have, but I didn't.
To be clear to you listening, I went to Roderick Chambers and recommended this book, and he sprinted through it and then said, oh, when do I get to read it on the show? And I said, when do you get to what now? And he invited himself on, and I gladly accepted his invitation because I quite thoroughly enjoy Rod's company. But it makes no surprise to me that he sprinted through to the end of this thing because it was just the enthusiasm top to bottom. Enthusiasm this book deserves.
Mm. Well, I loved it because it was an Australian book which was in a place that I could understand. You know, I've been up some sort of winding road to that sort of snowy place, and it seemed less like something that you would find in America or Europe or often that these sorts of novels are set. And you sort of don't feel that, I guess, kinship with the setting of the place, and it sort of sounded a bit like one of those chalets, like at Charlotte's Pass or something, in days gone by. That was a little bit, a little bit remote, and then you can understand the whole cut off bit, and you don't have to have sort of like Dartmoor or something in between you and the help from the police, because that's important, isn't it? You've got to get cut off from the police whilst all these murders continue to happen around you.
Well, yeah, at the same time, though, it is also very clear that they're not really cut off. People are coming and going as the thing goes. So we go over to another lodge and there's a party going on.
Well, there's like hundreds of people there.
That surprised me, I'll have to say. I didn't think there was going to be a party going on. And then it was interesting to see, too, that it was one of those sort of El Cheapo places that everyone that's there has to be sort of under 23 and drunk and up on something or other.
I mean, I did enjoy, and we spoke about this a bit last week, the use of him getting punched in the face, of Ern getting punched in the face as a clue.
Yeah.
Saying that if that were a real platinum Rolex watch or whatever it was.
A bit more weight behind it.
Yeah. Then it would have broken my jaw, he says, and looks over at Officer Crawford pointedly. But I really enjoy that that's a clue that is about the sense of touch. There are a lot of clues that we talked about last week that were sonic clues. Mm-hmm. The big one that I forgot to mention last week, Jeremy says, Ma.
With an American lilt.
Even though he said ma'am multiple times before, he says Ma to Audrey. And we're supposed to think that this is a slip of the tongue that is completely innocent, but it's him literally calling his mother Ma. But yeah, I really enjoy how many clues there are in this story that are based on senses other than sight. I wish there were more taste-based clues to kind of round things out, but
someone should have licked the pigeon.
Yeah.
Did you think that the amount of that money was an odd thing to start off with, which was an obvious sort of thing to follow or not?
The amount of the money. You mean the
267,025 cents or whatever?
As I kind of alluded to earlier, I'm not a big money guy. I am not, like, in real life, I am not obsessed with money. So
that's a lie.
That is not a lie. You shush your mouth. I hate money. Anyway, no, I love, you know what, let's move on.
Would you like a shovel for that?
Shovel. Hand me a shovel made of diamonds. Anyway. Yeah, I feel like I definitely did struggle to kind of follow the money. I didn't think too hard about why it was only 267,000 and why that was such a specific number that we needed. My brain went as far as money exchanged hands. This seems like a motivator. We're trying to buy some important evidence. The evidence is probably around Rebecca and her role in the story.
So, like, who has 267,000? It's got to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, Ern does point out in the chapter that it's introduced that it is a weird figure of money to have.
Exactly. But even points it out. You go, oh.
Yeah, the story sort of leaves it alone. Other than just reminding you the total, it's kind of encouraging you to think about it, but not necessarily providing you the tools so much as an open-ended space to guess, which is sort of fun. Yeah. Because in a murder mystery, which is very directing in this way, that points you at the clues so bluntly and has the narration kind of subvert your opportunities for guesswork, that money being just an open book is sort of a fun tool in that way, I think.
Mm, yeah, it is. And I was immediately trying to work out, you know, what would the difference between, you know, that and 300,000, or if it's half a million, or if someone's taking a proportion. I was trying to work out proportions and think, like, well, maybe why? There were three people involved. You know, that sort of thing was sort of hinting at me. And I'd go back to it every now and again thinking, oh, well, maybe this is part of the reason.
I mean, then you're starting to do financial maths in your murder mystery.
I know, it was driving me crazy. It's too late at night when I was reading this.
This is what I'd say. You're starting to do a banker's work, you know, you're trying to put everything together, doing accounting when you're reading this fun metafiction murder mystery where everyone has killed someone. I don't know. It just takes me out of it, trying to juggle those.
Let's get on to the next death sort of thing.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you are the sort of person who does like thinking about that sort of thing, it does provide you an opportunity. There are people, psychopaths, who enjoy the timetabling puzzles that a lot of murder mysteries have. Oh.
And like the device of like every single chapter has a death. Is that nice?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, good or bad as a fact that we have this many deaths or that we have a different death per chapter is less significant to me than how effectively Benjamin Stevenson used that choice in this book. So I think it was fantastic in this book, but I would hesitate to say that it is a blanket good thing.
Yeah. No, you don't want to use it everywhere, do you?
Yeah.
No. Well, I think there's also something to be said for the challenge of it, because clearly this is a challenge that Mr. Benjamin Stevenson is setting for himself.
Yeah.
And it does lead to some awkwardness, like Lucy's death, as Rod has kind of, you know, you've brushed up against, and also the question of who Audrey killed.
Oh, yes.
Which is kind of a weird question because she didn't physically kill anybody. The self of Jeremy has been killed. Andrew and Ern kill the same person.
Yeah.
Which is also the same person that Audrey killed metaphorically, so we're triple dipping.
That's
which
is fine. Is that cheating?
I don't think so.
Well, it's like when we were talking about Return of the Obra Dinn, and there's a scene in the Return of the Obra Dinn where there's a firing squad, and the thing that we were talking about in that is that the firing squad sort of has a purpose in that intentionally you don't know who actually did the kill to kind of absolve the guilt of the individual members in that firing squad. And I think that Ernest, Audrey, and Andy all sort of don't feel like characters who are deserving of that level of guilt. Sure. And thus by having all three of them kill the same person, it's sort of a moral signifier as well, which is kind of a fun idea.
I suppose
it is. I never thought of it that way.
I do also want to say before we get to the very end of this that I really enjoyed reading the acknowledgement section.
Particularly
there's a bit about how he apologizes for all the page numbers and chapter numbers
that he uses. Yes.
And at the very end he says, you know, thank you for reading and I hope you had fun. And I want to say that as much as we've been going back and forth on like, is this fair? Is this good writing? I had such a great time with this novel.
Yeah.
And I would strongly, highly recommend it to anyone who wants just a real good time.
Yeah, this is the most Death of the Reader book we have ever covered on the show. It was basically written for us. And I really want to congratulate Benjamin Stevenson on that. And I'm so looking forward to talking with him about it again.
Absolutely.
Now that we've kind of gotten the full depth of it ready to go.
You can do the debrief.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it is like he has written it for anyone that is a murder mystery freak.
Mm-hmm.
And I am
correct
in,
word.
In the I'm in the presence of greatness, I know. But then there's people you're probably out there too thinking, well, actually I know almost as much as Flex and Herds, and you're probably right. But there's all these little extra things in for you guys, and I'm thinking, oh, Knox, I'm sure that means so much to these guys, and I'm glad because I thought there's a lot in that I don't know, but nevertheless there's still enough in it around when he's giving you these little breadcrumbs that still made it very interesting for me too.
Yeah.
It's good.
As awesome. A newbie.
Well, Herds, last thing, I think I'm going to give you 2 points for this book.
2 points!
You're very close on the third, but I want to set a bit of a precedent now that we're bringing the points back down to three that I want to be harsher on them.
Ooh.
I want to be harsher on them.
Ooh.
And I
think because of Marcello and buying the lodge.
Very harsh,
and
I think,
yeah.
No, well, it's partially because of Marcello and buying the lodge, but it's mainly because you thought that Michael knew who Jeremy was.
But Michael wasn't really that bright, really.
How dare you?
Wow. Slander the dead.
Eddie. Anyhow, this is your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3. Next week, we'll be back with Glass Onion. We're going to be doing a little bit of a recap on that film because we couldn't not cover it. And it was a grand old time. It's definitely up there as potentially my favorite film at the moment.
I don't know if it's my favorite. I don't know if it beats you, the OG Knives Out, but that is an incredibly highly rated film by ourselves and critics alike.
We'll have to debate that.
We'll have to fight about it.
See you next week for that. I know we're a bit late to the punch, but I will gladly watch this movie again.
Who wins, my Knives Out or your Glass Onion?
We'll find out on your Murder Mystery World Tour next week on 2SER 107.3.